Hi, I'm Michael, and welcome to Beyond the Screenplay, the podcast where each week we do a conversational deep dive analysis into a film. Today we are talking about Casablanca, the 1942 film directed by Michael Curtiz, screenplay by Julius J. Epstein, Philip G. Epstein, and Howard Koch, based on the play by Murray Burnett and Joan Allison. I'm joined by the Beyond the Screenplay team, Trisha Arand.
Hello, everyone.
Brian Bittner.
Hello.
And Alex Calleras.
Hi.
Okay, so we're talking about Casablanca, one of the greatest films of all time.
I am.
Brian's just going to hate on it this whole episode.
Right. Not at all.
I'd love to see him trying. Yeah, so this film is wonderful. And I remember being very resistant to seeing it throughout most of, you know, I think I saw it when I was like 22. So earlier than I've had worse offenders, probably. But, you know, growing up, you see clips, you see the parodies, you know, you feel like you know so much about it. And it's like, right. Oh, it's that old movie and this thing and those quotes and blah, blah, blah. And I remember being, forced to watch it and just loving it, like just being like transported to this whole other place and just like, wow, this movie is so good. I think it was like a girl I was dating showed it to me, and then like she went home, and then I like watched it again because I was like, no, but like, wait a minute, that movie was really good. And so I've seen it several times since then. Haven't seen it in a little while now, but was really excited to dive back in. And just the writing is incredible. The performances are incredible. The camera, there's a reason why it's regarded as one of the greatest films ever made. And there are just so many lessons to extract from it. It feels classic, but it feels contemporary and modern also at the same time. There's just so much going on here. So I love this movie. I can't wait to talk about it with you guys. I want to hear your guys' relationship with this movie. So Trisha, tell me about Casablanca.
Oh boy, this is one of my favorite movies ever. I've seen it dozens upon dozens of times, probably. It's one of the ones I go back to all the time when I'm looking for something to watch. And like, I watched it probably two nights ago in preparation for this podcast. I would watch it again right now. It's so good. Like, it's astounding to me that the movie was able to capture these universal things. And obviously we talk about universality and specificity all the time, but it's one of these rare love stories that, because of the situation that the characters are bound up in, there's no right answer. And it's so that the entanglement of it is so compelling, the way that the characters are kind of stuck in the situations that they're in. And like, each scene is just full of conflict. Like, every single scene is loaded with like, who's to say what, what's going to happen next? Like, and the stakes keep ratcheting up and ratcheting up for the characters. And like, it's also equal parts, it feels like, sort of dramatic thriller and also like love story and also like comedy in places. It's really funny, and it's the kind of funny that's witty in a way that I don't feel like movies are often witty anymore, where they're not relying on, like, the situations themselves are not funny. And there's not really physical comedy, I would say, either. It's just, like, this really sharp wit that makes the scenes so memorable. And there's a reason why so many of these lines, like, the most famous movie lines of all time, like, I don't know, a dozen of them are in this movie, maybe.
At least.
And every time I show it to someone new, they're like, oh, that's where this is from. Oh, that? Yeah. Oh, I know that line, too. And it's like, yeah, that's because the dialogue is incredible.
The entire final scene feels like, you're right, watching a parody of other movies at this point.
Totally. Anyway, it's so good. I can't wait to unpack every little bit of it with you guys, although I guess we're only going to be here for too short of a time.
Right. We will do what we can.
Like Paris.
I know. We'll always have this podcast.
Awesome. Yes. Okay, cool. Brian, what about you?
I watched it back probably in my early 20s when I was kind of doing a, required reading of a bunch of classic films. And liked it right away. It was really I think it was one of those movies where I realized you can't, there are these old movies that are still, that do still feel modern, you know, and are very watchable and entertaining. And, you know, structure, like time hasn't changed much in 80 years in terms of the average length of a movie. Obviously, movies are getting longer these days, but you still have plenty of movies that are just like hour 50 minutes and like the structure is roughly the same. But yeah, I think watching Casablanca and Sunset Boulevard and Double Indemnity were like, that kind of made me go, oh, wow, okay, movies aren't too old. Like, you can watch old movies and still right. be like, oh, yeah. No, I'm totally, like, this feels modern. The language and, you know, certain things about it are going to feel old and feel dated. But in terms of just watching a story unfold in front of you, it absolutely is, you know, still feels very modern. And yeah, I've seen it a few times since then. I wrote a column about it back in the day, which was really fun to revisit it and really think about it. You know, it's a movie that you can watch and just sort of enjoy the kind of spectacle of it and the romance of it, but then to watch it and really kind of dig into it, which many people have done over the past 80 years, but it just really, it's a movie that becomes more and more rewarding the more you think about it, as some of the best movies do, whether it's Jurassic Park or The Matrix or something like that, where you're like, oh no, this movie gets better when you think about it, as opposed to other movies where you're like, that was really fun. And then when you think about it, you're like, oh, that falls apart so hard. And it wasn't about anything and it didn't mean, you know, this movie just like it sort of holds up to all sorts of scrutiny, which I think makes it really, really exciting to talk about so many years later. And then, yeah, watching again for this was just, you know, things I hadn't thought about before, things I'd noticed before, things I'm sure you guys will point out that I hadn't thought about before. So excited to chat with you guys about it.
Awesome. Yeah, so much to talk about. Cool. Alex, what about you?
So I feel like some shame with this movie because I saw it when I was like, I don't know, middle school, high school. Like, I was basically too young to appreciate it. And like, what mm-hmm. didn't follow the geopolitics, didn't follow the time period of what was really going on in the world and why are these people here? What are they talking about? So however I saw it, I don't recall. I know I've seen it and I have a bunch of images from it in my head, also from pop culture. But I really did not appreciate it. I thought like that was fine. It was kind of boring. They were talking about a lot of stuff I didn't really follow. So watching it last night, I was like, holy cow, this movie is so good. Why have I not revisited it before now? My God, this is wrong. Because it's just like, holy cow, it feels like the pinnacle of filmmaking like happened then. Like, if you want to just like do a laundry list of like, just what should a movie accomplish? Like just a standard good movie. It feels like this one did it and just like did it the best. And you can do variations on this and do different kinds of movies. But as far as just like a good movie, like every scene in this movie is so efficient and is doing two or three things at once. And you've got, yeah, the incredibly witty, always entertaining dialogue, but you've also got great structural work. You've got great stakes in place and like intractable situations. It's never a dull moment, but it's also complex and smart and very much in a time and a place, and it has a theme. Man, it's just like, wow, it's doing it all in 1942. They'd already figured it all out by then. You know, that's the old movie, you know, like BS perspective that is easy to get into in your 20s or whatever. Of just, I mean, yeah, they made movies back then, but like we really figured them out, you know, in my era, like in the 90s was when they figured it out. And this just shows you, no, like you can watch a movie like Casablanca today and it feels, like you said, Brian, incredibly modern because it does everything that I would hope a modern screenplay would do. And there's very little, I mean, there's a little bit of easing into it because you start with the kind of, you know, the Globe and the News of the World kind of voiceover and, you know, the first scene on the street still kind of feels old movie-ish the way it unfolds, you know, with the guys being shot. But very quickly, as the movie moves into Rick's and you start getting these vignettes of people and you start meeting the main characters, very quickly, there's no like goggles you have to put on to like forgive it for being an old movie.
Right.
It's just good. And that is just so impressive because I was ready to go in with those goggles and be like, you know what? I'm going to appreciate it for what it is. It was made in 1942. Like there's going to be a lot of bumps, but like I'm going to forgive it. And pretty quickly I was like, nope, no bumps. I'm just enjoying this ride and everything keeps happening exactly as I want it to. And it's just getting better and better. Holy crap. So yeah, I am on board the Casablanca train 100%. I loved it. It was so great.
That makes me so happy to hear, Alex.
I wanted to watch it again today, but I didn't have time. I was I was really excited.
I'll watch it with you anytime.
Now I want to see it in theaters. Now I'm gonna tune it out for incredible. Like American Cinematheque. Yeah, something in LA.
Oh yeah.
Well, and it's so interesting. Yeah, the phrasing that you were using there of like, you know, oh, they figured it out in 1942. And what's fascinating about this movie, given how perfect it is that it is also had a famously not smooth production and the writing process and, you know, writing new scenes every single day and figuring it out as, you know, as they were shooting it, basically, which I think I'd gotten some of that context like from my dad before I watched it for the first time. But it, like, you don't need that context to appreciate it, obviously. Trisha, I feel like maybe you know more about some of the like behind the scenesy stuff that was happening.
Yeah, I mean, just as a brief summary. So this is based on an unproduced play, and it was like the play itself was like optioned or sold, I think, for, you know, actually a good chunk of money at that time. And, you know, keep in mind, this is the Hollywood studio system. So this is where movies are being made, like at an assembly line. And stars belong to certain studios. And there's just, you know, a big guy behind a desk in like a big room smoking a cigar. And he's just making decisions about what.
Played by Sydney Greenstreet.
Yeah, he is. Or whoever played him in Mank or whatever.
Right.
But yeah, so this is like. Movies are very much thought of as, you know, I guess products in the way that we kind of think about movies now. Except that studios were making so many more of them. Like, we're talking hundreds of movies a year. And they're making pretty much straight genre stuff, right? They're making adventures, they're making musicals, they're making romances, they're making like slapstick comedies. And that's kind of it. And this movie was not intended to be special. Like, you know, everybody belongs to the studio. They have this play. They think there's some potential there. But given the war and everything that was going on in the war, it seemed like a, you know, kind of salient piece of IP that the studio could acquire and adapt. Yeah, go ahead, Michael.
I think I heard that the reader that read the play, that it came in like on December 8th. Like right after, right. Like the day after the bombing of Pearl Harbor.
And exactly.
Like, oh, this is extremely relevant.
So they saw a chance to kind of like, make a wartime picture. And it's interesting because the wartime pictures that you typically see from this era are like made afterward, right? Because it was kind of like, here's how everything shakes out. And we kind of like have the lenses on, or they're like just about people in the trenches kind of thing. So anyway, all that to say, they had only about half the script written when they like went into production. And even though the love triangle was essentially the same and does essentially have the same ending in the play, they certainly hadn't decided like how the details of the like everything was gonna kind of shake out. And like a lot of the subplots too, those are completely new. Those are not from the play. And how they interweave with, you know, Rick's arc, that's all was just kind of made up as they went along. And they had, I don't know, a crazy number of, like so many different writers that came in and did passes. And the fact that this feels cohesive, like it feels like no moment of it is wasted and the theme is in every bit of it. And like every piece of dialogue is super smart and, you know, pointing directly at the theme. Is astounding. So yeah, it's just one of these examples of like, you could never make this again. And this is also not how you should make movies. Right. Like, engineer it, use this as a template to then carefully engineer a movie, but don't fly by the seat of your pants the way that the people who are making this movie did. And that's, I think, like, there were tons of other movies that were being made that were, you know, about the war, about romance, about this and that, and, you know, set in Europe and intrigue and thrillers and all this stuff. And we don't remember any of them. And there's a reason why I remember Casablanca.
Yeah. And I think that there is something really huge to be said about the fact that it was speaking to the war that was still happening.
Oh, you know?
Yeah. I remember I saw The Great Dictator for the first time about 2 years ago in the Charlie Chaplin movie. And that was 2 years earlier, 1940. And he is like playing Hitler and like giving a speech to camera about how people should and should not behave. And like, first of all, it feels like, can he give that speech today? You know, like it felt like so like crazily, you know, relevant watching it in 2019 or whenever I watched it. But there's a, you know, there's a ballsiness there, right? Because granted, we're always making art that speaks to the time. You know, most recently we have something like Don't Look Up, right? A very different kind of thing. But I mean, I guess not that different from The Great Dictator if you think about just like hard satire, right? That's like, mm-hmm. we are going to be kind of cartoony, but we are going to make like really strong points to wink to camera. But it just feels to me, knowing what World War II was, it feels like it feels more of a, like it was more of a risk maybe, you know, to do that kind of stuff. Cause you genuinely didn't know if, you know, 6 months from now you were going to be invaded and then they're going to be like, oh, you're the one who made this movie, huh? Well, guess what? Sorry for you. So I don't know. There feels like there's, you know, a strength there and like kind of an irreverence and a boldness to these movies. And I think that is why they feel, even if you don't even watch these movies with your what was going on at the time brain on, I think there is a sort of passion behind the filmmaking that just shines through.
I mean, when I watched this movie last night and realized it was 1942, I didn't know that. I really thought it was a post-war movie. And it really made it poignant, you know, watching this movie about these characters in the situation where it's like, no, this is in the, when this movie was made, mm-hmm. this was current day. This was mm-hmm. not being made about an event that had resolved. This was an ongoing, you know, global crisis, refugee crisis.
Yeah. And there is a very pointed message in here about American isolationism, right? And right. so, and right. that had literally just like ended and America had just entered the war. So actually, this right. is not set in 1942. It's set in 1938 before America has entered the war. And so, you know, there's that beautiful line where he's like, what time is it in New York City? I bet they're asleep in New York City. I bet they're asleep all over America.
Mm. Right.
And there's a reason why the character of Rick is like, his whole thing is he has to get involved in the fight, right? He doesn't want to get involved in the fight, but right. it's the right thing to do. And that's very pointed commentary for something that literally had just happened. So it, you know, again, this is like political satire that is like piping hot, not satire, but commentary that is piping hot
right,
from the studio here. And the fact that like, you know, again, yeah, we know how it ended. And this is like, this is the thing that turns the war, right? Like, Rick gets involved and like he helps Laszlo escape. And this is the thing that makes the difference in, you know, what is conveniently and truly considered to be like the greatest battle of the century or the greatest, you know, conflict of the century. I think that's a big part of the reason we're all still here.
Yeah.
Talking
well,
about
yeah, and I think that's, like, I remember watching the movie the first time being really entertained by it, but then watching it again and reading about it and like letting all of the layers that are happening sink in, where just like you're saying, like Rick is a symbolic representation of the United States. And like yep. all of everything that's happening has this greater thematic, symbolic meaning to it that is there if you want to think about it in that way. And is very pointed, as you're saying, and even like the last lines, like, this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship, says the American to the, uh-huh. the European, like uh-huh. all these things. There's just so much, so many layers and so much meaning to it. And I was watching a behind the scenes thing and it was an interview with some professor from NYU or something, but talking about this era of, you know, the studio system, as you were saying, Trisha, and just like classic Hollywood in this period of time where movies could be both art and entertainment. And where this is a movie filled with artistic flair and aesthetics and intention, but is also extremely entertaining. And yeah, kind of learning that like Michael Curtiz, the director, that was one of the things that he often sought in the films that he was making, is like, how do I kind of take this maybe singular genre piece and like smash it together with some other stuff. So this is a melodrama love story, but it's also a political thriller, like we're saying. It's a film noir. Like, the cinematography is definitely borrowing from all these noir inspiration things. And yeah, it's just such a fun blend of things that all work and support each other. As we're saying, like, the dialogue is super witty. It's a comedy, kind of. And I think that's it. Watching it most recently, it made me sad that we don't have more movies like this that are trying to operate on all these different, like, levels that we've kind of, like, sifted and sorted into, like, well, like, art films are A24 films, and, like, entertainment is over here, and there's, like, all these different things. I just love that this is a movie that has it all, and obviously not every movie can have it all, but I want more movies to try, because
yeah,
it's great.
It's why Parasite rocks. Because I it's something I talk about a lot, which is, like, you do have these sort of the sort of spectrum, right, where it's like, here's the movie that's trying to, like, be really thematically heavy and really talk about a thing and be really philosophical and whatever, and then here's Ambulance or whatever, like, you know, here's, like, the just like the blockbuster and stuff, and there's plenty of stuff in between, but it feels like only maybe a couple times a year, if that, do we get that movie that, like you said, Michael, just feels like it's doing everything. And again, that's why, you know, Casablanca is not mentioning all these, you know, pop figures from the time, right, these relevant things, because it maybe knows that it wants to be a movie that's relevant in 80 years. If you are making all these references to be like, we're going to call you out, you know, General such and such, for not signing that thing back in the place or whatever, then that movie becomes dated in 5 years. But when you just make a movie that's, like, kind of a cool, tense romance, then you can just watch that movie with your entertainment brain on and just have a good time, or you can dig into it, you know, and do the thematic work and do the historical work and all that kind of thing, and then be like, oh no, this movie is working on, you know, it's working, banging on all cylinders, is like a
firing.
Yeah,
there you go.
It's doing its work with, when you go to the place and then the thing happens and you're like, thing happened. Yeah.
Yeah,
right,
that's the metaphor.
You know, getting your letters of transit to the proper recipients can be very difficult. Your couriers might get killed, the papers stolen, causing a whole hubbub that could leave the whole fate of the world in question. You know what's easy? Sending files with Massive. Massive is a file sharing service that lets media professionals quickly transfer terabytes of data to anyone in the world over the cloud. With Massive, there are no limits to the amount of data you can send, and Massive has 150 servers worldwide, which means whoever you're sending the file to will be able to download it at a maximum unthrottled speed. Transfers are encrypted, so no one but the sender and recipient can access the files. And sending files with Massive is super simple. You don't need a subscription to sign up or a complicated IT setup. Just pay as you go at 25 cents per gigabyte. To learn more and to sign up for Massive, head to massive.io/beyond-the-screenplay. When you sign up at that link, you'll get 100 gigabytes free towards your transfer. That's massive.io/beyond-the-screenplay for 100 gigabytes free. No letters of transit required. The link is in the show notes. Thanks to Massive for sponsoring Beyond the Screenplay. Now, back to the episode.
I mean, maybe this is a good time to talk about the construction of the characters, because yeah. I think
that's
the characters...
what I was just doing.
What do you think banging on all the things meant, Trisha?
I think the characters are what help to, like, hold everything together, because the tone, weaving the comedy into the thriller elements, into, you know, the sort of drama, melodrama, romance elements, that only works because of the way that the characters are designed. And we understand that Rick's dry sort of sense of humor is a defense mechanism for him, right? This entire movie is about Rick's, like, walls coming down and mm-hmm. his assertion that, you know, he's the only cause he's interested in. He sticks his neck out for nobody. And, you know, all the wonderful, amazing lines that we get from him about how little he cares about anything. Mm-hmm. He's not a part of the war. He only has a sporting interest in, you know, whatever, whether Laszlo escapes or not, all of that stuff. all of that is a part of the character. So while we register that wit as being funny, and some of the greatest lines in this are just delivered so dryly and straight by Humphrey Bogart, and he's amazing. But we also understand he's not there to crack a joke to us, the audience. He's dealing with the situation that's in front of him by kind of, you know, giving us this sort of sarcastic and dry sense of humor. The same thing with the other, you know, primary comedic character in this, who is Renaud. And he's, you know, thinks of himself as being like a little bit of the life of the party. Like, he's kind of constructed the perfect setup for himself where he can have whatever he wants in this town, and is trying to play both sides of everything and charm everybody and keep the situation chill. And so he's kind of lightly like making light of everything. And those things are baked into the characters. They don't feel like they're disrupting the underlying tension of the movie or the underlying conflict of the movie. In fact, they are feeding into it by like reinforcing these characters' facades. And that's why I think the tone ultimately works. Because you know who doesn't crack jokes? Ilsa. Laszlo.
Laszlo, like, yeah.
Nobody else, basically. There are a few other little moments of levity, right? With like Sasha, the bartender, and some of the other people around.
And Sam. And, Sam.
Yeah. Those people have like little moments here and there. But mostly it's putting the humor onto these two characters, and it's an active part of the character design and the theme. It's their facade. And I just think that's such a smart way to approach something. And that's why I love it. Like, again, it's not physical comedy. It's not situational comedy. It's just the wit in the dialogue that rises organically out of the character design.
Right.
That's such a good point.
So the characters who are trying to like learn English. And so,
yes. Oh, I love this.
What watch? Yeah. 10 watch. Such watch?
Such much.
That's pretty funny. Yeah, every like small character too is so well drawn. And you're never taken out of the movie by any like lesser actors that are kind of brought in for a scene. Even you know, characters that are in one scene, like that young couple that are trying to win the roulette, like she's so striking and memorable in that scene with him. And yeah, I'm never taken out of the movie because somebody comes off as, you know, just like a extra, or like they don't really belong in this time and place. They're kind of standing out as like, oh, just an actor. There's something that really, what's the word, immersive about the world of Rick's and this universe that, yeah, the artifice isn't really there. You're just in Casablanca with these. And, you know, I think about talking about Rick's, the defense mechanisms. I think that's such a good point, Tricia, about how the comedy is not cracking jokes for joke's sake, not trying to insert comedy to make sure the audience is still happy. It's truly part and parcel with his struggle over the course of the movie, which is just, he has so many defenses up and he has to learn to kind of get back in touch with who he used to be. And I think it's so wonderful how the movie always shows us a little bit of that heart of gold peeking through. Like from the beginning, there's little acts of kindness that he's doing for people, even as he says and tries to outwardly present himself as, I don't care, I don't care, I don't care. And it's just it's so wonderful to watch a movie where a character is that complete, where from the beginning, you can see that inner struggle coming out and it's so real. Like we know that person that is putting up the sarcastic defense mechanism, but also really cares, and their actions are tipping the hat to, they do have a heart and they do care actually, but they're scared and they don't want to be taken advantage of or feel vulnerable again.
We see a lot of movies where a character has that arc, but it doesn't feel earned at all. It just sort of feels like, well, it's the third act, so now they feel differently than they did the entire movie. And it's almost like it's cool because no one's going to see it coming or whatever. And it's like, no, but then we didn't see it coming. Therefore, it doesn't feel earned or organic at all. And like you said, you start to get like, that's what that young couple is so crucial to Rick's arc, because it's like, oh, he just stuck his neck out for someone. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, right.
That's the turning point, you know, but I do think there's smaller, less risky actions he takes throughout the movie, which I really appreciated.
I think we were saying in a recent episode about theme, you know, better to be on the nose, in your face, for the audience, front and center with your theme, than not have it at all. And this movie definitely is not shy about putting the theme of, you know, Rick needs, like, Rick has a soft underbelly and he has his guard up, and this story is basically about that, like watching his defense mechanisms come down. There's all these little subtle things, but also Renault at one point is just like, you're super cynical. I think underneath there you actually have like a really like soft heart because you did this thing and you did that thing. And so like that's definitely there in the audience's mind. And then kind of getting to some of the structural abnormalities, there's the flashback, right? Mm-hmm. Where it's like now we go to a Paris flashback for a little bit, kind of 20 minutes into this film, 2030. It's an interesting choice, but I feel like it really cements this idea of like, oh, there is a real Rick under there. Like there is, we get to know that him, and now we've seen them together and how in love they were. And so now it's like a deepening of the investment for us of like, well, we want to see that Rick come back now that we've, you know, had a relationship with that Rick as well.
Also, they totally did the before sunrise, before sunset thing.
Like, oh, the train.
She left him at the train station. Yeah, didn't meet him there.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, this movie is so good at introducing characters before we meet them. And it helps to create like our expectations and the construction of them. And so like it does it like a few times, right? Where we get it with Rick, obviously. And then there's like a wonderful reveal, right? Where so first we hear about Rick from Renault, and then he's like, oh, he'll be at Rick's. Everybody comes to Rick. Rick never drinks with customers. We hear that, you know. And then we finally get to see him like playing chess with himself, like, you know, signing checks and whatever. It's the character's built up before we even get to meet him. And then, of course, immediately is tested, right? And when Ugarte shows up with the letters of transit and all that stuff. And so we get that. But we also get the same thing with Laszlo, right? Where it's like, oh, Victor Laszlo, that's interesting. He's coming into my bar. Mm. And someone comments like, oh, I don't ever think I've seen you impressed, Rick. Like, that's fascinating. And it does it even like a little bit with Ilsa, even though we don't know we're looking for her, right? Someone, I think it's Renault says like, oh, I was informed you were the most beautiful woman in Casablanca. But actually, even before that, he says, you know, he'll take one. No, I've seen the lady, right?
Right.
And so there's just these little things of like, it helps us stay oriented, but it also constructs the characters for us. And they do the same thing with the Paris flashback, where we know that Rick and Ilsa knew each other in Paris because they talk about it in dialogue. And only then after they talk about it in dialogue, where we have a certain expectation of it, then we see it for real. So I think it's just like a really masterful like delay in like showing us things. Like they almost tell us about it before they show it to us. But it works because we're seeing the contrast between what we've heard about a thing and then what we actually see about either that person or that situation.
Definitely. And it also feels like this movie is like prequel proof because of everything you're saying, where it's just like, where it's like you put the prequel in the movie and then there 80 years later, no one's made a crappy prequel because it's like, no, I guess we already saw all that stuff. We can't put it, but you know, if there was just a monologue about you left me at the train station, sweetheart, then it would just be like how many plays and movies and terrible things would have been made showing it. It's like, no, just put your prequel in the movie. That's my lesson.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And it is interesting, you know, Captain Renault is a really fascinating character because, you know, he has his own moral complexities and he's maybe further on the side of spectrum, further than Rick on the spectrum of like cynical and maybe unlikable, and that he's, you know, he's skeezy. He's running some stuff.
A very bad guy.
Sex for papers.
Right. Very bad. To be clear.
Yes, which I don't think I like fully picked up on until this most recent one. And I was like, oh, wow. OK, impressive that you managed to get that past, you know, the censors back in the day.
There was some heavy rewriting.
Right. Yeah.
I feel like there's a scene in the police station where somebody's like, the blonde is here, you know, for her papers. And he's just supposed to like take off his tie or something.
He buttons it. Yeah. We know what's going on. So, clearly not a great person. But also, like, the function that he serves, it is interesting that he's almost an audience surrogate in a weird way, which just kind of came to me as you were talking there, Trisha, because so much of what we're told about Rick comes from him and his kind of commenting as we're saying, like, you know, Rick says, I don't stick my neck out for anybody. And he's like, why is foreign policy? I'm with you. But then when, like, you know, Rick does have a drink, he's like, wait a minute, I've never seen this happen before. Like, oh my God, like, look at how you're changing is basically what he's saying, mm-hmm. like many times throughout. But again, in this like organic way that feels natural to the character because of the way the character is designed. And so again, it's that thing where it's serving a function, but also it's like it's serving 10 functions at once and none of them feel wrong, which is very impressive.
That's why this movie feels like so modern, I think, to me, is that it is often doing many things at once, where you're doing maybe some thematic work where you're pointing out the theme to the audience, but also this character pointing out that theme right now is actually adding tension to this scene because he's making this comment about Rick and like, oh, Rick, you never do this. Why are you doing this right now? The German soldiers are over there. You're sitting down with Victor Laszlo. Like, you know, there's both, you know, in the scene, stakes are being raised, themes are being called out. The character speaking is revealing their insecurities and their stuff. And that's just the best kind of just scene work. Like I wrote down just, all the scenes are scenes. And I think what I meant by that was that, like, yeah, every character speaking every line, it's revealing character. It's upping the ante with the stakes. It's complicating things. It's getting at the theme, which I think just we want from every scene. We want every scene to be doing all these things at once. And this is a movie that remarkably it's just stacked with those scenes mm-hmm. where all those things are happening all the time.
Yeah, I was weirdly thinking about Blade Runner 2049, where we were talking about how that's a movie where you don't always know what each scene is doing, but you're sort of like, but I'm in the hands of a capable filmmaker, so I know that all of these scenes are important. And then you realize by the end, like, okay, this is where we were going with all of this. And I think Casablanca is not as sort of wayward as 2049, but I feel like there is kind of in the second act a little bit of like, wait, who has the papers and what's going on with Rick and Nelson? Like, where are we going? Especially the first handful of times you watch the movie until you know exactly, you know, where all the chess pieces are moving. But as you were just saying, Alex, and I would say this with 2049 also, the scenes themselves are entertaining. So you're like, okay, maybe I don't know exactly what this scene is doing for the bigger plot, but I'm having a good time watching this scene. And then by the end of the movie, I'm going to feel like everything we went through was worth it to get here.
Yeah, there's a little bit of confusion, I think, on a first time viewing, because there is misdirection, who's going on the plane, and like different people are told different stories about who the papers are for. And I like that. I think it does make for a great reveal at the end and allow Rick to make that final choice at the last moment. But it is, on a first viewing, it is confusing. You're like, wait, who knows what and who thinks what and what plan is being sold to who? is a lot to track.
They didn't know much of the time while they were making it.
I was wondering that right. When I heard that they were writing it like on the day, I'm like, I wonder if they knew in this scene, like who was getting on the plane yet.
Right. Yeah. Like so much of like the love triangle and who was Ilsa really going to end up with was kind of like being figured out as they were shooting. And I agree that I think that's one of the reasons why like where they landed with all of it is so compelling, and how these characters are drawn and the love triangle itself is really, really fascinating. Trisha, do you have some thoughts on the love triangle that you'd like to share?
I have a few, but really quickly, going back to what you were saying, Alex, about the complexity of the plot, I agree. But one of the things that I love about especially the middle act of this is that the subplots of it are basically feeding into Rick's arc directly, even when they're not feeding into like the main story of the Letters of Transit, right? So like, things with, you know, the amazing like singing duel in the middle, you know, in the bar where the Germans start singing and then they start playing La Marseillaise and they start, you know, singing in a singing war, if you will. And that has nothing to do with the Letters of Transit, right? It's not like someone in the bar is like, we're going to do this because of that. But it is feeding into Rick's arc and the tension of like okay, Victor Laszlo, it might be too dangerous to let him stay here, according to the Nazis, so they might try to kill him. And so, like, it's becoming more urgent that he escape. And so Ilsa especially is affected after that scene where she's getting more and more desperate to get Rick to give her the letters of transit. The same thing with even, like, little, you know, moments earlier where the scene with Yvonne, who is the woman that's in love with Rick at the beginning, and he sends her home because he's not that interested in her, and then she comes back in with the German soldier. The act that we see him doing earlier when he sends her home and, like, he's brushing her off but as nicely as he can is, like, feeding into Rick's arc, where we start to see, like, okay, he's actually not interested in any women whatsoever, but he's not a totally bad guy. And then we start to see how that, like, plays out. Again, it has something to do with his arc. And you guys have already pointed out the young couple and how much that has nothing to do with the letters of transit, but it is about Rick's arc completely. And so it might feel confusing where you're like, why am I watching this person I've never seen before sit down with Rick and explain her situation? Pretty quickly, it becomes evident why that's important to us, because it's important to what's happening to Rick.
I mean, that scene is so remarkable, too, because they managed to put Ilsa's words in that woman's mouth, like, word for word, but it makes perfect sense for the situation that woman is describing, which is having to sleep with the police captain. Mm-hmm. Like the, you know, if someone had to do something, like, horrible to, like, save the person she loved, you know, could you ever forgive her? Like, I, for a minute, I blacked out and I was like, is she actually, like, did Ilsa send her in here to, like, get him to talk to her and then to deliver this message? And then I realized, oh no, the writers found exactly the perfect situation for her to be in, that those words could come out of her mouth and just essentially speak for Ilsa too. And that, I mean, once again, brilliant writing that could be pulled off, and it's 100% believable. Like, there's no stretch that happened.
Yeah. Well, and in all those scenes, as you're mentioning, Tricia, where it's maybe not about the plot and the MacGuffin of the magical transit papers, but it is about, like, Rick's arc, he also has moments of, like, tiny choice where, like, you know, he yeah. sends the woman home with the bar guy, but he does a, like, and come home, like, quickly, like, like, you know, we get yeah. the insinuation of, like, he's looking after her. It's kind of a save the cat moment, weirdly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or in, yeah, the singing war, you know, when Laszlo was like, play this thing, the band has to look to Rick for mm-hmm. permission, and Rick gives them permission. And so, like, those are moments where it is revealing Rick and signaling where he is on this arc of change and the polarity that he's dealing with.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
But one of the things about that I think makes the love triangle so unique, as you mentioned a minute ago, Michael, is that the love triangle itself is so embedded in the story world and so dependent upon, like, the stakes of the larger world and the story world. And to a point where you can't make other movies like this, right? Like, you can't tie the fate of the world to your love triangle most of the time. Right. You could try, but it's pretty hard to do in a believable way. And I think but that's why this feels so, like, sweeping and big and epic, even though it really is about, you know, the problems of these three little people. And so I think that the ways in which the movie takes care to, like, enwrap the characters in the war and, like, you know, it's already a powder keg of a situation that they're all thrown into, which is just smart in terms of premise. But then especially with Laszlo, he's a resistance leader, right? And, like, do he and Ilsa love each other? Sure. But there's also, like, he's a little older than she is. She always, like, respected him and looked up to him. And so she feels tied and connected to his work, right? And they kind of have to tell us that in dialogue where it's like, you're a part of his work, the thing that keeps him going. Mm-hmm, but right. We kind of see that too. And there's that beautiful moment of choice when they're in the Blue Parrot, when, you know, sorry, what's his face? The owner of the Blue Parrot tells Ilsa, I can get a visa for you. I can get you out. Mm-hmm. Do you want to go? And Laszlo tries to send her away. And we can see how, and Ilsa can see how hollow that is, where he's like, I would like you to go. She's like, would you go without me? And he's like, definitely I would. And she's like, you definitely would not. You've had a few opportunities to do that. So we're in this together. That moment is super critical also for us understanding the thing that they tell us in dialogue, which is he needs her and he's too important, right? And so to like stay in Casablanca or be killed by the Nazis. And so again, there's this attention to the stakes at every moment that make the love triangle feel so much, I don't know, I think the thing when you think about this movie is you think about the moral dilemma, mm-hmm. because it's not just about who loves who.
Right. Yeah.
When you have a love triangle as a writer, the bulk of your work has to be about making the choice hard.
Yes.
And this choice could not be harder for anybody involved. And it's very, very interesting. And of course, there's a masterful little switch right there at the crisis where technically it should be Ilsa's choice because she's the person at the hinge of the love triangle, but she makes Rick do it. Mm. And I think that that's mm-hmm. also like a really essential structural thing because she's like, I can't think anymore. I can't leave you. You have to think for all right. of us now. And I was like, okay, well, I mean, it is his movie, right? Yeah. So like, right. it's a really interesting, it's good screenwriting. But yeah, I also think that
I identify with her. Sometimes you're just you're exhausted. you just decide for us.
You thought your husband was dead. You fell in love with this guy. Your husband's still alive. You left the guy you loved. It's so much.
So much.
Yeah. I mean, everything you're saying, I think it's cool structurally how this movie ups the stakes from a general stakes, which it establishes in the opening minute, right? Which is like everyone's here in purgatory and like they want to get out, but they've been here for years. Here's a guy getting shot in the street. Like this is real, you know? And then, oh, here's this woman you have some history with. And then not until about the midpoint, there is still very much a present history between the two of you. Like, you know, the movie sort of takes a little time to say like, okay, Rick and Ilsa, there's still something very much going on between them. It's not just a thing in the past. And then now we have all the pieces, as any good midpoint should, we have all the pieces in place to be like, now we are, the rest of this movie is like, there's the general stakes here, but there's also the very, very personal stakes, right? So you're worried about everyone, just their safety, but you're also worried about these two characters and, you know, them being together. And yeah, as you were saying, Tricia, like it puts everyone in kind of an impossible situation. Like Ilsa wants to escape. She wants Laszlo to escape. She wants Rick to be happy. She wants to be with Laszlo. She wants to be with Rick, you know, and like everybody has so many things that they want. And we as the audience want, because again, these sort of building stakes from a very broad standpoint to a very intimate personal standpoint.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're identifying, Brian, one of the really great things about this love triangle is that you kind of want all of the options.
Right.
You know, like the love she has with Laszlo is a real kind of love. It's a kind of commitment to support each other and you know, you have a larger cause outside of yourself, and together you're going to do this really important thing. And then her and Rick, it's a different kind of love. It's romantic love. It's just it's less mission based. It's less kind of husband and wife, we're life partners based. It's like we fell in love in Paris and have this, you know, chemistry with each other that I've never felt before, even with my husband, who I love in this other way, but not this way. And, you know, we want both those things for our characters, and they can't have them both. So it's a great love triangle, because, you know, the worst thing is when you watch a rom-com and it's just like, this person kind of sucks basically in every way, and this person's perfect. Like, who should you end up with? I don't know. and in this one, it's like, I genuinely want both for you, and you can't have both. Mm-hmm. And there's no good option here.
Yeah.
Which is what you want.
And that's why you can use the debate about who she should end up with as character development for your characters. If you were saying, say, making When Harry Met Sally, because it is a debate,
right.
And like who you choose, like right. reveals character, because it is, you know, clearly drawn on all sides, the thing. And it is fascinating how the stakes kind of creep up on you in a way that or that's my experience anyway, where it feels like it should be obvious from the beginning, but it's not. It's like there, because it's almost like the frog boiling thing, right? Where every little bit the stakes raise and rise and rise until at some point I'm like, wait, at some point, like, I thought this was just who loves who, but now it's like the fate of the literal world is riding on this love story. How did we get here and why am I so invested in it? And I think that's like what's so powerful about it is the final choice that Rick makes for everybody of sending them away on the, like, choosing the greater good over love and like sacrifice. Like, I think that is such a powerful choice to make and extra poignant given the historical context of it, of like, you know, some things are more important than the love of these couple people. Like, we need to do what's right for the greater good. So I think that's, it's almost just like the cherry on top of all of this, is that it would also just be a great love story if, you know, then they all wound up happily ever after. But I think it's powerful and memorable because it is a slightly, you know, the character gets what they need, but not what they want. Yeah. And it's also the thing that the world needs at the same time.
Yeah.
It's just impressive.
Yeah, I mean, that's, once again, that's why it's so poignant that it was happening right in the middle of World War II, right when America got involved. I mean, it's just like, wow, what an incredible piece of art to reflect like everything in the cultural zeitgeist at that moment. And the idea of, you maybe had a vision for your life and, you know, the plans for how you wanted to live your kind of individual life, that may not be in the cards because you're living in this time, in this moment. We are in a time where you have to put aside your individual desires and there's a bigger thing happening that needs you. And that's a really powerful statement to make.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's such a rare message, it feels like. It's hard to think about other movies that are willing to sacrifice like the happiness of the main characters. Mm. And, you know, movies, romantic movies especially, teach us that like love conquers all, and like you should give up anything in the whole world and everything, like burn your whole life down to be with the person that you like, love. Like, that's what movies tell us. And the fact that this movie like goes to all the trouble to break our hearts along with Rick's, when we see the Paris sequence and when we see him standing in the rain in the train platform and we see the like terrible, cynical person he's become because he had his heart broken, the movie puts us and Rick through all of that to the point where we then want nothing more than his happiness and for him to be with Ilsa. And it almost convinces us that like he can have it and also like be the person he needs to be, like that maybe he can, it can go, you know, he can get what he wants and what he needs because Ilsa loves him too. So like, isn't there a way? Like, just put Ilsa on the, just put Laszlo on the plane by himself. Like, I don't, you know?
Right.
So we're doing the like mental work of like, there must be a way because we've been trained to think that way. And movie audiences even back then had been trained to think that way, that romantic love is the highest ideal. Mm. And the fact that this movie suggests otherwise is beautiful and different. And again, you can't imitate it because the like, the explosive situation that they, all the characters are tied up in, is so specific. But you know, it's that it does echo choices that a lot of us have been through in our lives, which is like, do I really truly, if I love this person, do I really truly want what's best for them? And that's in itself a question that like, I think is relatable, even if the fate of the free world does not rest on it.
Right. Also, you've now put a third or like fourth Star Wars reference into my brain when I watched this movie, which is that this all feels like Rogue One now, where it's like, we did the thing that's going to fix the war, but like, we're not happy. We just had to do the thing, you know? So in real, Casablanca is speaking to real life, right? Where it's like the choice that Rick makes at the end is then going to affect our real world. Obviously, in Rogue One, it's the choice that is made is going to affect our real original trilogy. But I already always thought about Star Wars with this movie, because specifically when like Straza gets off the plane and is walking, I'm just like, oh, that's the Emperor and Vader walking. It's like even shot from the same angle. And Rick's feels like the Mos Eisley Cantina. It's just, and of course, it's Casablanca. Like, you are going to, movies are going to borrow from this movie for the rest of time, probably. So it's interesting to watch an older movie and go, oh, this feels so much like this recent thing. You're like, oh, right, because the recent thing probably borrowed from that original thing, which is probably why some of the classics still feel so relevant, I think, is because movies have been, movies have been trying to be Billy Wilder movies for like, since Billy Wilder's been making movies. And I feel like that's why they feel so relevant. Cause like, oh yeah, it's not just that they were ahead of their time necessarily. It's also just people were like, I want to keep making that movie forever. The big difference I notice, total like sidetrack here, but for like the time before the end of the movie feels so different when you watch movies from like pre-1950. I watched the 39 Steps recently and there was like 9 minutes left in the file. And I was like in the stream that I was watching and I was like, we haven't gotten there yet. And it's like, first of all, there's no end credits, right? Now we have 11 minutes of end credits. But then second of all, it's just like the third act is saved for so late where it's like everything happens and then the movie is over. And, you know, this movie especially, it's like we get that whole speech at the airport and then Straza and then let's go, Louis. And then the movie is over. And we're so used to, 40 minutes before the end of the movie, we're like, we're starting to get into all the third act stuff and we're going to sit through a big battle and all this stuff's going to happen. And I love that this movie and a lot of movies from this era just feel like they really save it so that the last 10 minutes is this like beautiful payoff where you just feel like so excited by the end of the movie and you don't feel like you've been watching the ending for half an hour.
I was going to say, when you mentioned there's like modern techniques, one of them felt like there's some walk and talk moments where I was feeling very like Aaron Sorkin walk and talk, like just a great snappy conversation happening with a dolly shot. And just, that's why it feels so new. We're still trying to achieve this in our best kind of character writing movies.
And one of the things I was watching, they were talking again about Michael Curtiz's style. And there was like, it was basically saying like camera moves. He didn't like the camera to move for no reason. Like all camera moves should be motivated, which is like David Fincher's like whole thing. And so it was another one of those moments of like, oh, right. Like everybody's been borrowing from the old classics like Casablanca for forever. And I think, again, that's why even the way it's shot, even the editing, like the editing feels contemporary. It's not like there's a bunch of really long shots or kind of overly relying on, not that it's bad, but just there's
the timing. There's perfect. Yeah.
Timing and rhythm and speed to it that doesn't feel rushed, but does feel like modern. And it's really a good movie.
As someone who doesn't study didn't study cinematography, I find I'm falling more and more in love with watching older movies and studying the shot composition, whether it's this movie or Citizen Kane is a huge one. I've talked a lot about Kurosawa. You're just like, man, they thought so hard, and especially in black and white, right? Because you just have such a stark contrast of everything. And it's just beautiful to watch some of the lighting in this movie and some of the shots, the shadow on the wall and all that kind of thing where you're just like,
I mean, when he opens the safe, that shot is just like a flex. Where his silhouette, like when he opens the safe, he's off screen. And see this perfect silhouette of Rick as he continues the conversation. Yeah, it's too good.
I want all movies to be in black and white and all third acts to be super short moving forward.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Why don't we go around and say what lessons we're going to take from Casablanca. Trisha, what's your lesson?
Sure. So my two favorite scenes in this movie, well, one of my favorite scenes and then another one that comes right after it, are the ones where Ilsa comes to Rick's place to get the letters of transit deep in the middle of the second act, or deep at the end of the second act, which is really the crisis point. And that scene itself, as a microcosm, is just beautifully done of the central conflict is in the scene. It's full of subtext, right? She's there where, because he's already predicted that she'll come like to his apartment some night. And then she shows up and she's trying to get the letters of transit. And, you know, she's kind of like begging at first, or like she's asking, she's like playing on their history. She's trying and then, you know, begging. And then she eventually threatens. And then he like is like, go ahead and shoot me. You'll be doing me a favor. And then like, it, you know, devolves into just the story of like what happened. It's such a wonderful scene. But it ends with the handoff I talked about, which is where Ilsa kind of gives up on making the choice herself. She's like, I never have the strength to leave you again. But like, please just help Laszlo get out. Right. Like, and we see that Rick is conflicted about that. The scene immediately after, they are interrupted in that moment. And because what's his name? Carl. Carl and Laszlo come back to the bar from the resistance meeting, and he has Carl take Ilsa home, and then he goes down and talks at the bar for a minute with Laszlo. And Laszlo, this is like the pivotal moment where we start to think to ourselves, like, what's Rick going to do? And Laszlo admits that he knows that Rick and Ilsa are in love. The movie has never told us that up until that point. Right. Where there's a little bit of plausible deniability where we think maybe Laszlo doesn't know, because he does ask Ilsa straight out in the scene before he goes to the resistance meeting where he's like, I know what it's like to be lonely. Is there anything else you want to tell me? And she's like, no, there isn't. He's like, OK. And so we kind of think maybe he truly doesn't know, or he suspects, but who knows? But then he flat out tells Rick, he's like, I know you're in love with a woman. It's a weird coincidence, but I'm in love with the same woman. And he right away makes the self-sacrificial choice. Laszlo's like, fine, you don't have to help me, but I want her to be safe. I actually wish that you would take her away. Like, I would rather that she go and be with you so she will be safe. And just like, if you have the letters of transit, just save my wife because I love her. Okay. Well, you can't send that. You can't screw that guy over now. Like, he's too good. Like,
right.
And so those two scenes back to back create the context for which we start to see the finale unfold. And I think they're just both really critical character moments where Rick is dealing with Ilsa and he's like, I don't know what to do about this. The person I'm in love with is here. And that whole scene is incredible. And then here Laszlo walks in. It reinforces the intractable question. There's no drama if the answer is easy.
Yep.
The answer has to be the hardest thing it can possibly be. The answer has to be so difficult we can't even imagine it. And I think that's the thing that as Rick's plan plays out, is that we don't even know what he's actually going to do. Like, he's like, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. As you're pointing out, I think as you pointed out earlier, Alex, it's like, he tells multiple people different things about what he's going to do when he's selling the blue parrot and all this, when he's selling the bar to the owner of the blue parrot and all of this stuff. We're just like, I don't know what Rick is planning to do, but surely he's going to get the girl in some way. But he also can't screw over Laszlo, and it should just be so difficult and like this Gordian knot that just can't be untied. And that's what drama is.
Yeah. And I feel like both of those scenes are also where the performances stood out to me, where like Rick Bergman is so good. Cause in that scene, there's, you know, you're seeing her have to like confess, like, yes, I'm still in love with you, all this stuff. But then there's like a little niggle in the back of my brain that's like, but is she just saying that? Like, is this part of the persuasion also? And even later, I believe Rick kind of said, there's a whole lot of like, I know that she was pretending, but then Renal is like, I know that you know that she wasn't pretending. They do a lot of like trying to explain, like, what was she really like? Is she really in love or not? But I love that it's ambiguous enough that it leaves room for the complexity and the difficulty of that choice. And it feels like a very adult choice and push and pull. Yes. That it's like, these are crazy times. People do things when they're in love. We're not going to be petty about it. Like, the stakes are too high. Like,
yes,
let's just get to what really matters. And like almost that focus and not worrying about like, did you cheat on me or did I cheat on him? Like, that that isn't the main focus of the pull, I think also deepens the like, no, we're just talking about like the deep feelings, like what do people truly want, which makes that choice, as you're saying, that much more intractable.
Yeah.
The single tear going down Ingrid Bergman's face while she's holding the gun and like standing in that shaft of light. It's incredible.
Yeah. Cinema.
Yeah, my lesson is pretty much the same. And Alex said a lot of it, which is just sort of like having your third person, you know, when you have two romantic leads you're sort of rooting for, having the third person actually be a good guy just is so much more interesting. And I remember, I think I mentioned this on the podcast before, there's this movie Unfaithful, the Adrian Lyne movie from like 2002 with Richard Gere and Diane Lane and Oliver Martinez. And I remember, you know, when I was 20 watching that movie and being like, oh, it's interesting that her husband isn't like terrible. Like, and for all I haven't seen this movie in 20 years, for all I know, he's a dick, but like, but it wasn't like the obvious, like, well, of course she's going to go have this affair because her husband is awful. You know, it was just like, oh no, like he's kind of an okay guy, but then she is having, who am I rooting for? What am I doing here? You know? And that is the fun you get of this kind of thing. It makes it feel more interesting for you as the audience, and it makes it feel more realistic, right? Because we seldom have villains in our life. And there are places for villains, right? We have Straza in this movie. It's like, look, there's a Nazi. Great. We're on the same page. Yeah. And if we're not on the same page, you're probably not watching Casablanca. I was thinking about the Office, the American Office, with Roy and Karen. So Pam's fiance in the first season and first couple seasons. And then Jim's girlfriend, Karen, played by Rashida Jones in the third season. And Roy is just a dick, basically. He is like the easy, we don't want you to be with this person, right? And that's a great way to get us as the audience on board with Jim and Pam, because we are going like, oh no, terrible choice. We want these two characters to be together. Easy choice. But there's still great drama to be had from that. But then by the third season, now we introduce Karen and it's like, oh wait, she's actually kind of cool. And like she and Jim have fun together. I kind of like her. And like, maybe, I mean, no, but maybe this is, you know, and that just makes it would be so easy to just give Jim like a terrible girlfriend who then we were like, well, no, I hate this. Why are you with her? Like, you know, wake up. But it just makes it so much more interesting to have that third person be kind of a good guy. And what's interesting about Casablanca, the third person isn't Laszlo, it's Rick. Right. It's just that who is our protagonist, right? Our protagonist is Rick. But you could see this movie as told from the point of view of either Ilsa or Laszlo, where they are together and like they're just trying to escape the war. But then this ex comes into play, Rick, who owns this play, and he's got the papers, right? And what, you know, this guy, like, I got to get the papers from him, get your wife's name out of my mouth. So I just find it interesting that we don't have a clear, you know, as we talked about before, we don't know exactly what we want, right? And then it's like we get the best ending that we can have because we like Laszlo, so we want him to be okay. We don't want Rick and if Rick and Ilsa run away together, then Laszlo's stuck behind in Casablanca. That sucks, right? We don't want that ending either, right? So it's like it forces us to go like, what is the ending we want? And then therefore we are on board all up and right up until the last minute, rather than being like, we know what's going to happen. We knew it half an hour ago. We're just waiting for it to happen now. This makes things a lot more interesting. It really puts you on the edge of your seat for the whole movie.
100%. Good. Again, good movie. Does the things very well. It's frustrating. It's hard sometimes talking about these movies where it's like, I imagine like there's a dartboard and you could just throw a dartboard at a movie and it's divided up into like, writing, cinematography, acting, like doesn't matter where the dart hits.
Yep.
It's amazing.
Good.
And it's a good thing. Alex, what's your good thing? No pressure.
I'll stay on the Laszlo train and just say that basically I think if you're gonna hang, you know, the dilemma on this man like being so important, we do need to see why he's important at some point. And like what makes him so special and why him? Like, why does he need to escape and not some other resistance? And I think that the sing off, you know, between the two anthems or whatever in Rick's club is that moment. And we see how he takes charge. He's fearless. He knows the Nazis are over there singing. He's not afraid to get in their face and ruin their song. And we see how people like the girl that Rick sent home that night, she was going out with some just random German officer, kind of giving up on taking a stand in this fight. She is singing the anthem. She's crying. We see how he's inspiring people like her who had just kind of turned to nihilism and were just on the sidelines, activating them into this effort. So such a smart addition to have that scene and to have him instigate it, because we see, oh, this is what this one man can do. He can turn this whole bar against the Nazis in this town just from this act of rebellion, and because of he's so fearless, he has no hesitation to just put his life on the line standing up to the enemy. So yeah, you got to have, if you're going to hang this much on somebody like that, we got to see him in action, understand why him, and this movie finds a way to do that just in a bar, which is brilliant. Yeah. No war scenes or flashbacks necessary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that kind of ties into my lesson and one of the aspects of it being this time I really felt that it was based on a stage play. And I think that it's so cinematic that it's easy for that to be lost or not be so overt like it can be sometimes when a stage play is adapted to a film and it's like, oh, it's weird that we're just in this one set this whole time. But yeah, like so much of this obviously takes place at Rick's, but there's all these different like mini worlds within Rick's that we're kind of moving between. And that's just always really fascinating. But I think it also allows for all the side characters to have something to do. Like each of them has an arc, or like almost every person that is introduced comes back and has a moment, like what you're pointing out, Alex, where the woman that Rick sends home has that triumphant moment where like she has an arc where she's like, I'm with Rick, everything's messed up, now I'm with this German person, it's sad, and now I'm having this like triumphant moment where I'm like standing behind my country. Like everybody has something like that where we see them multiple times and it's on theme and it makes this world feel immersive, I think, as you said earlier, Alex, and just well realized, well drawn. And I think it's such a, I love it when it's there. And I think it's a sign of just a well constructed movie to be able to have, you know, to know that in the beginning, you're going to see an airplane flying over the heads of like refugees wanting to leave. And you're going to see a young woman and her husband, and she's going to say, maybe tomorrow that'll be us on the plane. And then an hour later, she comes back and she's critical to the plot. Like, that's so good. Like, I just love when it's just a sign of a really well-organized, thought-through film, and it just amplifies everything else in such a great way. And that's my favorite thing.
And one of the things we didn't get to talk about too much, so I want to say, like, maybe we can move this over to the Discord or social media or wherever, because I would love to talk to people about it, is stage plays are great examples of dialogue always. People in stage plays have to speak well, because there's so much, like, that's really the information that you're getting is what people are saying in a stage play. And there's more to playwriting, but if you want to study really great dialogue, study movies that are based on plays. And there is no better example than Casablanca. Rick's final monologue, like, you could just break it down line by line. And like, I've got a job to do too, where I'm going, you can't follow what I've got to do. You can't be any part of. Just beautiful writing. And so we didn't get to talk about it that much, but let's keep discussing and kind of diving into some of that stuff, because I could just talk about it for hours.
Yeah. I also think it's true of just whatever the text of your screenplay is, whether it's dialogue or action, it is, that has to communicate what you're trying to communicate. You know, I've had people respond to things I've written and say like, oh, well, I didn't quite get that, but like maybe in the directing. And I'm like, no. If it's not there now, like that's not okay. I can't wait until someone directs this to like make sure that moment is clear. If it's not clear, I haven't done my job. And that's doubly true with dialogue, especially in movies or plays that are basically just dialogue scenes.
I think that discipline is definitely an important thing to be aware of, like, if your answer to the solution of the problem is like, it'll all be fine once we've shot it and put it together. Right. Once we've spent all the money and you can't go back and everything's written in stone. Yeah, that's probably not the best way to try to solve your problem.
We've all done it.
It's true. Yeah. Very true. Awesome. Okay. What else have you guys been watching recently? Alex, what have you been watching recently?
So I've been watching The Dropout on Hulu, which is the limited series about Elizabeth Holmes and the Theranos scandal. Holmes is played by Amanda Seyfried, and she is fantastic. And the show is great. Like, I haven't really followed the Theranos story much. Like, I just know there's something about The Voice, and it's about a blood machine that was fake. But the story, so this is based on a podcast also called The Dropout. That was an ABC News, like, investigative podcast series. Just went in a deep dive of, like, who is this woman who defrauded so many people and managed to get so far with basically an entirely, like, fake technology. And it's a really fascinating character. And it's got a great cast. The show's stars Naveen Andrews, William H. Macy, Stephen Fry. Just really great actors playing really fun, interesting characters. And it's just a really well-made show. I was thinking it was going to be more of a caricature or just kind of, I don't know, maybe just a pure satire of this weird situation and person, but it treats the character kind of as a full human being. They're really trying to understand who is this person who is, you could probably label a sociopath, but like what drives her and what led so many people to kind of like fall in line behind her and go on this journey that ended with like a massive Silicon Valley debacle. And it's just a really fun, well-made show. So I'd highly recommend The Dropout on Hulu.
Yeah, I've been hearing good things. I don't know very much about it either. And I've been trying to decide, like, do I wait for like the Jennifer like Lawrence movie or like which one of these things? Should I watch the documentary first and then watch the show? And I don't know what to do. So I'm just kind of
there's
waiting.
Too much Elizabeth Holmes Theranos content yes. out there. It's such a fascinating story that it just, yeah, everybody wants to make something about it. But yeah, having not seen any documentaries or, yeah, the upcoming Jennifer Lawrence movie, this adaptation of, you know, that is, I'm sure, highly fictionalized, but this adaptation of her story is fantastic.
Cool. Brian, what have you been watching?
I went to a double feature rock opera screening of The Who's Tommy and Pink Floyd's The Wall. Both movies I watched as a teen, especially The Wall. I'm a big Pink Floyd fan, but I had not seen it in quite a while. They're weirdly both really bonkers rock operas about a kid who loses his father in World War II and has a strained relationship with his mother and then becomes kind of a cult leader. In Tommy, he's sort of a spiritual leader, and in The Wall, he's a fascist, like a pure fascist leader. And of course, how that brings them down by the end of the movie. And yeah, Tommy is like not a great movie if you're trying to watch a movie, but it's just this like acid trip that's really fun with Roger Daltrey from The Who as Tommy, who's just like beautiful to look at. And then Anne Margaret plays his mother and Oliver Reed plays his stepfather. And then there's cameos and songs from Elton John, Eric Clapton, Tina Turner, and Jack Nicholson. It's so weird. It's so fun. There's a lot of beans. And
what?
Oh, yeah. Anne Margaret and beans, if that's your thing. And then The Wall, I love so much. It doesn't have as much of a notable cast. Bob Geldof plays Pink, the main character, and there's a surprise Bob Hoskins who has like one line, but it's like a real film. Like just the 5 minutes in, I was like, oh yeah, this movie's like made by a filmmaker, which it is. Alan Parker directed Midnight Express, Fame, Angel Heart, Mississippi Burning, Evita. Like it's a, you know, a real filmmaker, whereas Tommy, the director, made like mostly musical documentaries and stuff. And it's like, okay, that's why that doesn't feel like quite as much of a movie. But yeah, I also hadn't seen The Wall in quite a while. So I got choked up within the first 20 minutes, just like, oh yeah, I love this music. I love this movie. If you haven't seen them, you know, they're not must-sees for a film, you know, buff or whatever. But if you just want to see some like really interesting rock operas from the 70s and 80s that also are just like really fun stories with some good music and stuff. Check them out. The Who's Tommy and Pink Floyd's The Wall.
Wow.
Very nice.
Yep.
Awesome. Okay, cool. Trisha, what have you been watching?
So I'm about 20 minutes from the end of Deep Water, and I will check back in with you when I finish it.
Because I've heard things about the ending.
Ooh, yeah, I don't know how it's going to end. It's been a little bit of a journey already.
Michael, you know what Deep Water is, right?
The erotic Ben Affleck
thriller. Yeah. Oh, right.
Based on a Patricia Highsmith novel. My gal Patricia Highsmith, which is why I'm watching it.
Okay.
Oh, I just saw Very Pretty People and...
Rotten Tomato scores.
We'll circle back. I'm not done with
Directed
that.
By the director of Unfaithful, the Italian Lane Richard. Yeah.
Wow. Anyway, so a movie that I did finish, though, recently that I really, really enjoyed is the movie Notorious, starring Ingrid Bergman and Cary Grant. From 1946. So somehow it was a gap in my Hitchcock filmography. It's a Hitchcock movie. Ingrid Bergman made a few right after Casablanca. She made Spellbound and Gaslight and this one. And I don't know how I had missed this, but it's so great. Like, so it's Ingrid Bergman playing totally the opposite type that she plays in Casablanca. She plays kind of like a party girl. And her father is a convicted Nazi. And so she gets recruited by Cary Grant, who like works for the CIA. And she's supposed to be a spy and like embed herself in like this ring of former Nazis who now live in Rio de Janeiro. And it's like a love story. It's a thriller. It's great. It's a great Hitchcock. Like, set pieces are really tense and, you know, dramatic, and they all build, and like it's a psychological sort of, you know, thriller kind of thing as she's leading this double life. But anyway, I'd never seen it before, and if you two have missed it, I really, really recommend it.
It sounds great.
Nice.
I want to see it now.
Very cool. Yeah, I finally watched The Last Duel, so I'm catching up with things. And I really enjoyed it. It was a movie where by the end I was like, I think that was a movie. I feel like that was kind of like a unique thing that I haven't seen in a while. And I mean, I'm sure I knew this. I mean, so yeah, Ridley Scott, Matt Damon, Ben Affleck, Adam Driver, Jodie Comer. And I must have known that it was told from three different perspectives. Someone must have said that probably on the podcast to me, and I just forgot. But it was really interesting to see how just a simple story with the, you know, kind of designing principle of being, we're going to tell the same story from three different perspectives, was like so engaging. And, you know, the things that they reveal a little bit more, the things that are different, the things that aren't different. And then, as I remember you saying, Alex, the last duel is a quite tense duel indeed. So
it earns its place in the title, I think.
It does. Yeah. It was not like fun is probably not the right word, but it was a very entertaining movie that, for being 2.5 hours long, didn't feel as long as that, which is rare these days, I think. So,
and like a big historical period piece with a budget, with like vistas and sets,
right?
And
yeah,
historical period piece things.
Yeah, I think it was like pretty rare. The first battle sequence where I was just like, oh my god, it feels like forever since I've just seen a Ridley Scott like high frame rate
historical
battle sequence.
Epic. Yeah,
well, like, and the stakes are there, like they've spent, of course, like I feel like it's the, you know, and you don't know what's gonna happen, and it's always nice to be in a story where you don't know what's going to happen, but you care about the outcome. And it was great. Awesome. Okay. Well, this has been our conversation about Casablanca.
I think we said everything there is to say.
Yeah.
That's also never been said before.
Yeah, for sure.
Definitive podcast right here.
We could also just start over and do it again.
Yep.
And I would be fine with that also. Like, record it again.
Brian has to send us off with at least one impression, because we haven't gotten any.
Well, we have to talk about Peter Lorre, who, you know, our generation doesn't really know from anything except for Robin Williams as the genie saying, "I can't bring anyone back from the dead. It's a dirty job. I don't like doing it."
It's so true. Mm-hmm.
Beautiful. Yeah, it is weird that that is literally how I know that person.
Well, also, Bugs Bunny imitates him a lot.
Oh,
so
true.
If you grew up watching Bugs Bunny cartoons, he also does a good Peter Lorre.
References right. Bugs Bunny.
Yeah.
Peter Lorre is like in so many classic movies, but he's always just that guy who shows up for a couple scenes, like Arsenic and Old Lace and M, and oh my gosh, there's so many.
It'd be weird to watch that again. I remember watching that in film school and being like, do I like German expressionism?
maybe.
Awesome. Okay. Well, this has been our conversation about Casablanca. We want to say a big thank you, as always, to the patrons that make this show possible. Thank you to our producer, Vince Major. Thank you to our editors, Caleb Berg, Graham Harther, and Eric Schneider. I'm Michael Tucker, and I've been joined today by Trisha Rand, Brian Bittner, and Alex Kayotis. All of our Twitter handles are in the show notes. Send us a tweet and say hi, and we will see you in the next episode.
Bye, everybody.
As time goes, bye-bye.
Bye.